buttery nipples.
And that's what we had.
Yes, which led me down the path of asking Shane the query, have we talked recently about the time that we stayed up all night during Mardi Gras and ended up drinking in the morning with people whose lives had been ruined by alcohol?
Ruined by alcohol, yeah. Well, first off, let me say I brought in four pre-mixed shots of buttery nipples to share with everyone, but only three have been consumed because somebody's the Grinch.
Whatever.
I wouldn't say a Grinch. He just knows that maybe buttery nipples are not the greatest idea for him.
No, not especially pre-packaged buttery nipples.
I just had my ass handed to me
by two
small children. So
fine.
Pick your battles.
I don't think anybody looks at the package of pre-mixed buttery nipples and thinks it's going to be a good idea.
A great idea.
No, nobody says, hey, on the other side of this, I'm really looking forward to whatever that is.
Yeah. Well, so Ryan, yeah, we were in New Orleans.
Sleeping in a van
where a number of us went. This is...
As one does.
Yeah. There were probably eight of us backed into a van. Instead of getting a hotel room, we just got a parking spot in a garage and all slept in a van. And so one night after we left Bourbon Street, it was 4:30 or 5 in the morning, Ryan and I were walking back to the van, and one of the two of us had the brilliant idea. Like, you know, you can drink 24 hours a day in New Orleans. We were like, no shit, let's go do that. And so we went to this bar that was right around the corner from where the van was parked.
Everybody, what was everybody drinking? It was like Busch Tallboys.
Busch Tallboys. It's the only thing that the bar sold. Oh, they only sold Busch Tallboys. And so the bar was populated by people that were doing, like, the beer order came in, and some guy was, like, wheeling it in. They were all just doing favors
to be able to get their next beer.
So they could get their next beer. Yeah. Oh, and then we stumble out. I mean, we had a couple Busch Tallboys and came out, and it's daylight. That's an unsettling feeling to leave a bar and when you go in and it's dark and you come out and it's daylight instead of the other way around.
I had a conversation with a friend of mine who was living in New Orleans at the time, and I was like, you know, the thing about New Orleans is it's like we've all had that, you know, everybody's had that one experience where it's like you're standing in the middle of the street and you don't know where your friends are, and the sun's coming up and there may or may not be a cab barreling down on you, and she's like, and it's a Monday.
So, yeah, that sounds like New Orleans.
Yeah. But that girl was funny because she would just park her car downtown and then just forget where it was for a while. And I was like, that level of not giving a shit is amazing.
Last time I was there, I played a gig, and then I went out with the drummer from the band that we played with, who I had known before then. And the last thing I remember, we're in a bar where there were no lights, just candles. And the next thing I remember, I'm sitting in the courtyard of a no bullshit castle and it's noon. That's New Orleans.
That sounds about right.
Well, and I will say this is a tacky story, but I'll tell the nicest version of it I can, which is to say that when I was about the same age that you guys were and tripped out to New Orleans with a buddy of mine, it's the only time in my life. I'm not somebody who I don't frequent strip bars.
Strip clubs? Yeah. Adam, I know that's where you were going.
Yeah, so, but there are a lot of them in New Orleans, and you know, I was probably 19 or whatever, so buddy of mine and I go in there, and it's the only time in my life that I have ever seen a performer, we'll call her, do her dance, and then put a robe on, and then go solicit tips. That's the kind of joint we were dealing with that night.
Interesting.
Yeah. She was like, I'm not going to try this. This could get worse. Yeah. Or you could, I can just leave the robe on and you can cash out.
Well, it's Mardi Gras tomorrow, everybody. So that's why we're just going to tell a couple tribute stories to.
I have one more.
Oh, please do. We all have one more New Orleans.
I've got another one too, but
one of my favorite Mardi Gras stories is my brother and I have a buddy named Bankston who won Mardi Gras. Put on a Nixon mask and ran around running into people, bumping into him on purpose, going, pardon me.
You know, when you said he won Mardi Gras, in my head, it was W-O-N. Like,
well,
he won Mardi Gras.
He probably felt that way. Anyway, yeah, no, it's
yeah, I keep thinking of new New Orleans or old New Orleans stories, but we'll never get out of here.
Yeah, if we keep on going. Yeah, let's
that's a different podcast.
Let's get into the show now. I'm Shane.
I'm Ryan.
Kevin here.
And Mark.
Somebody likes it. So last night, there was the Saturday Night Live 40th anniversary.
3.5 hour.
Extravaganza. Yeah. High, mixed reviews on my part, but the highs were pretty high. It was pretty entertaining.
I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed the whole thing. I watched it all. But the thing that I wanted to talk about today was Kanye West's performance last night. Are you guys with me here? Did anybody...
I think I fast-forwarded.
Did you fast-forward it over it?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I saw a little bit of that. I wasn't exactly sure. I actually didn't get in on the very beginning of it. I got in early in the song, and I was like, what the hell is wrong with this Kerrang?
Yeah. Well, the song was great. Like, I loved the song. But he was laying on his back and had a mic, like, positioned above him and did the song laying on his back. And there were guests also that were running to the song that laid on their back. So he was basically laying on his back, and then there was, like, a white, like, screen behind him, like, just a white light and, like, a microphone. And, like, he's, like, just on his back rapping the song. Song was great. Just could not... What it made me roll my eyes the whole time. Like, come on. Like, remember we were talking last week about Lady Gaga with a meat dress and stuff, and like, it just, dude, you don't need
any.
He's
an eccentric dude.
He's a weird motherfucker, but it's so gimmicky. Like,
I felt like, I was like, you know, with all your success, it's a shame they can't get you a whole studio. Like, he just has to record in this like flat, like a deprivation chamber or whatever the hell that was. Like
a coffin. He's forced to lay on his back.
It's like a light coffin.
Sometimes the guy genuinely creates brilliant music. I think he's by far the most interesting thing happening in mainstream hip hop these days, and that's been going on for a little while now. But then all the fucking circus outside of it's just so bizarre. And we were talking about him getting on stage during Beck's award, you know, at the Grammys, and he's just he's an odd, and he's married to Kim Kardashian.
Yeah, you know.
Okay, this week's album, Kevin, you picked it.
Yeah.
Get us in there.
We're going to talk about the, it was funny because I mentioned this the tail end of last week's show that I thought it'd be fun for us to cover the Modern Lovers record. And so, of course, somebody looks it up and says, oh, there are like 4 or 5 Modern Lovers records. Well, yeah, I guess technically that's true. But really, there's one.
But not really.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Jonathan. You were right.
I'm glad that you bring it up because I was going to apologize to you tonight.
That's okay. But I didn't remember who said it. So I just sort of universally.
Producer over there.
Okay, yes. Yeah. Yes. So there is one original Modern Lovers record.
Yeah, and it's full of drama and intrigue and people that didn't get along and then went on to do other
interesting
things.
Well, it was recorded in like 1972, but wasn't released until 1976.
Yeah, one track was
he didn't want it released
in 71, and then he decided he wanted to be more calm. We'll get into all that, but yeah.
But anyway, so we're going to talk about the Modern Lovers.
Okay. Well,
Jonathan Richmond.
Yeah, I didn't have any. I mean, I heard about the Modern Lovers. I definitely had never heard them before, or at least this incarnation of... Because there was the Modern Lovers, the original thing, and then there was Jonathan Richmond in the Modern Lovers, totally different band, like kind of a revolving door cast of characters.
Sure.
Pretty much all I knew about the Modern Lovers was Jonathan Richmond's very twee mid-90s musical output. Like when he was like in...
There's
what's
the
deal
Mary.
With Mary or whatever
something
the fuck that
Mary.
Movie was
what's
called?
What's the deal with Mary?
Yeah. And
what's the deal with that girl?
With Mary.
What's her name?
Yeah.
Mary?
And, yeah, that one. And that shit, it was like him and a drummer or something. Like, and it's just...
Yeah, he's like a troubadour in a tree or something.
Yeah, but I mean, but that was his stage act at the time, too. Like, it was the what was in that movie, that was like his thing. That's what he did. It wasn't like created for the movie. It was like him and a drummer. And it was like, really?
See, that's the first time I had ever heard of Jonathan Richmond.
Was that movie?
Yeah.
What's the deal with that chick?
Saying that, I mean, I knew about Pablo Picasso when I was in high school.
Everybody does. Side, he's a pretty famous painter, dude.
Yeah, but the song, Pablo Picasso, I had heard that in high school. So, but I never knew there was any connection there.
Yeah, I always thought the story behind this album was really fascinating. And just the fact that, you know, that... It's the drummer from the Cars, and it's Jerry from the Talking Heads, and and the fact of the matter is like the zeitgeist of this band was like they couldn't get along enough to like. And here was the other thing that I thought was really fascinating is they like part of this record, is actually comprised of two separate demo sessions, one both for major labels. And so these guys had come out of Boston, and I don't know if it was just a, you know, it kind of makes, is one of those deals where it makes you feel like, oh, well, there just weren't as many bands and certainly weren't as many good ones. So everybody, come on down to the major studio and we'll just record some stuff.
Yeah, that was, yeah. They did three demos? Oh, no. They ended up doing more than that, too. Then one of the producers, yeah. I guess it says on the Wikipedia page, like, one of the producers came in, the sessions were shitty. And then they had him back to do another session. Like, I don't know about
like,
you guys.
Oh, yeah. This sucked last time.
Yeah,
let's
give it another try. Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's not like, oh, you do your demo on your four track in your garage. It's like, oh, come in. We'll have John Cale produce your demo.
Well, and he was the one who took the first crack at it. And I think a lot of the ones that end up on this record that are from those John Cale sessions are the songs that, like Pablo Picasso, that I really think are endemic of what I dig about this album and this band. But there's also some stuff from the other producer whose name currently escapes me. But he's a little bit, you know, everybody at this time, all of these guys were obsessed with the Velvet Underground.
Yeah, I know. Ken, is there?
Well, and I didn't even look anything up about this record on Wikipedia or anything until today. I've been listening to it like all week, and I was like, man, these guys sure do like Velvet Underground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was in real time. They were liking Velvet Underground when not everybody was liking Velvet Underground.
Sure, sure. So.
The first notes that I took, definite Velvet Underground influence, proto-punk. And then that's like
If you take like the Velvet Underground, add in like a dash of the Doors and maybe some like Iggy and the Stooges.
Here's the description of the band on Wikipedia. The sound of the band owes a great deal to the influence of Velvet Underground and is now sometimes classed as proto-punk. So yeah, me and Wikipedia we're on the same mind
you know,
on this one.
Going a step further, I mean, one of the things that gets called in for one of the pieces that I read, this is a little blurb from Sputnik Music. Mentioned that Jonathan Richman was essentially obsessed with the sound of Velvet Underground to the extent that after graduating high school, he moved from Boston to New York and slept on, I don't know how this, like, they leave out some details, but ended up sleeping on the sofa of Velvet Underground's manager, Steve Sesnick.
Yeah, I'd like to know. Like, there's like, know how boom, you get from point A to point B.
Exactly. But, I mean, like, you have to, you know, you've got to be dogged enough to get over there.
He had some moxie.
Yeah, he was just a
kid's
ballsy,
got moxie.
He was a ballsy teenager at a time when New York was pretty damn dangerous, and you know, you had to get in there and mix it up a little bit.
I just can we all admit, or can we like let's just all agree on this, that could there be a more fitting producer for their music than John Cale?
Oh,
like,
no, yeah, of course.
Like. That's sort of if you have some kid out there that their favorite band is the Smiths and they ended up having, you know, Johnny Marr produce a record or some shit like that. Like, yeah. It's pretty good stuff.
It's a good fit.
You know what? Why don't we listen to a song off it?
Let's do Roadrunner, because I have listened to this song so many times this week.
It's
and
really
I still,
good.
I still can't get enough of it.
And Roadrunner is the one that has been covered more
it's
often
sort of
than
the single, I guess, if there is one.
Yeah, this is definitely you know, there are singles albums and there are albums, and this is definitely an album, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah. But we'll talk all about that. Let's listen to Roadrunner first.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. An hour, gonna try fast and stop and shop with the radio on. I'm in love with Massachusetts and the neon when it's cold outside and the highway when it's late at night. Got the radio on, I'm like a roadrunner. Dark outside. I'm in love with Massachusetts. I'm in love with the radio on. It helps me from being alone late at night. It helps me from being lonely.
So, a couple of interesting things. One is that this album was out of print for 20 years. Like, 20 years. That to me is. Like
I did not realize that.
Really? Well, maybe that's why I never heard it before.
Well, maybe yes, it was hiding from you. But beyond that, I think the other,
thanks.
The other thing that like kind of puts the time period in perspective is that the Sex Pistols covered that song.
They Road did? Runner?
Yeah. Yeah.
They certainly did.
I didn't know that. Was it wasn't on Nevermind the Bullocks, was it?
No. No. Right.
I think it was released. It was released on a compilation.
No, that was the shit they did in the 90s. Mm.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. That's what it was. Yeah,
the Great Rock and Roll Swindle.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, they covered it, and some others have too, but I was like, well, that band hasn't been a band in ages, and that band is always a band that's sort of held up as a, you know, a pillar that that band influenced Joy Division. So like,
oh, you can hear that.
Like,
yeah.
It's a crazy little musical Tumblr world.
That band basically sounds like Austin, Texas in 1995
well,
to me.
I actually knew three of the songs off this record just because I used to hang out at Casino downtown, Casino El Camino, and they just have a really good jukebox and people would play these. And yeah,
I don't think I'd ever heard it. Even one of these. I mean, I'm sure I'd heard that song before.
Yeah.
But associated with another band, because not only do they sound like the Velvet Underground, but there's a lot of the songs on this record sound a lot like the Stooges to me.
Sure.
To me, yeah, it was Velvet Underground, Stooges, and the Doors, weirdly.
That's the key stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know what? I can kind of see that because he's kind of got a sing-song thing with the way that he sings. I will say this. Like, I like this record quite a bit. And part of the reason I know a lot of times I have a lot to say about people when the song there's not a lot of variation and tempos and there's not in this record. We went from like last week with the Kinks where there's a lot of variation throughout the record, and there's not in this record, but it doesn't matter. I mean, the whole record is cohesive and it sounds great. I could do without all the fucking soloing, though. Like a lot of these songs could be trimmed down by about a minute,
and they're not full on jam bandy.
No. Like, it's like cacophony.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
I also think it's a really solid record, but I kind of want to like grab Jonathan Richman. And granted, this is going back to 1972 when I was an infant, but grab him and go like, get a hold of yourself, man. You'll find a girlfriend. It's gonna be fine, dude.
Well, I always think that's one of the. I mean, one of the reviews that I got a kick out of going through was a guy who writes to the Guardian in the UK and was talking about, you know, they did a few segments a few years ago where several of these music writers for the Guardian just talked about an album that was their favorite. And then one of these guys wrote about this record, and he said that beyond everything else he said, the thing that really sort of helped him fall in love with it was that it's funny. Like, there are parts of this record that are funny, not the least of which is that the sort of contrarian position that Jonathan Richman takes, where he, like, you know, talks about liking the old people and hanging out with his parents and, like, his girlfriend didn't get that.
I love that his hair is cut really short, you know, like, I mean, at the time, like, nobody was cutting their hair short, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy to me that this music was made in 1972, by the way. And I pulled this up because I wanted to just talk about how different this was than what was being put out during that period of time.
Absolutely.
So I pulled up the top 100 songs of 1972 according to Billboard magazine, and I'd like to read a couple of them to you.
And
this record came out in 76, and I'd like to do the same thing. And what'd you say?
I said read them all.
Yeah, all 100 of them.
I'm not going to read all 100, but we're I'll read a few and you'll quickly
Andy
see
Kaufman
how different this band was than what was popular in 72.
Yeah.
But then I'm going to read 76 also or a few of them because it came out in 76. And let me just tell you this about 1976. Worlds away from 72, also worlds away from this record.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So these are the, let's see, like the top 15 songs from 1972. You'll know a lot of them. The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face by Roberta Flack, number one. Highest.
This is totally like that.
Yeah. Second, Alone Again Naturally, which is a great song. But number three.
Shane loves that song.
Yeah,
by the
it's
way, actually.
One of my favorite songs.
Yeah.
But it is really kitschy and definitely sound.
Well, for sure.
Yeah.
It's the most depressing song ever recorded.
It's the most depressing song ever recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. okay, number three, American Pie, Don McLean. Number four, Without You, Harry Nilsson. Number five. The number five song, highest charting song in 1972, "The Candyman" by Sammy Davis Jr.
Awesome,
nice.
Who? That was in the 70s. Like, don't you think of us like like lot long before that. Okay, I Gotcha by Joe Tex, Lean on Me, Bill Withers, Baby Don't Get Hooked on Me, Mac Davis, Brand New Key, Melanie, Daddy Don't Walk, Don't You Walk So Fast by Wayne Newton, Let's Stay Together, Al Green, good song, Brandy, You're a Fine Girl, Looking Glass. Anyway, let's go down a little bit further down. My Ding-a-Ling, Chuck Berry.
Good. Nice.
Again, who knew that came out in 1972? and number 16, If Loving You Is Wrong, I Don't Want to Be Right. Which one of the interesting things about that by Luther Ingram, one of the interesting things about that song is you usually see a parenthetical after the initial statement, but yeah. That one has a parenthetical before. If Loving You Is Wrong.
Oh, so the song is called I Don't Want to Be Right?
Yeah. No. But the way it's yeah. I Don't Want to Be Right is after, but on the title it's If Loving You
Is Wrong.
Yeah. Anyway.
I think you got it.
Yeah. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. Okay. So in 1976, again, big change, like sea change in music, but again, nothing to do with the sound. The first was Silly Love Songs by Wings. Don't Go Breaking My Heart. We all know that. Disco Lady by Johnny Taylor. Play That Funky Music by Wild Cherry. Kiss and Say Goodbye. Paul Simon, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. Walter Murphy and the Big Apple Man with a fifth of Beethoven. We all know that. Anyway, Afternoon Delight by Starland Vocal Band. Skipping around a little bit, Barry Manilow, I Write the Songs. So you guys can see what I'm saying here. Where the fuck did these guys come from? And because punk hadn't happened
Boston.
Yet. Yeah, thanks, you idiot. The punk hadn't happened yet. There was no indie rock. There wasn't, you know, there was like...
No, this is like proto-indie.
There was the Velvet Underground. Yeah. But the Velvet Underground is fascinating in and of itself, just because if you look at like what was really big when, you know, the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane, and then there's a fucking Velvet Underground. What the fuck? Where did that come from? And this is a similar kind of thing.
Yeah, Andy Warhol, I guess. Like Velvet Underground was sort of a byproduct of the factory.
I'm well familiar with their origin story, Ryan. I'm talking about like the musical culture that was predominant in that period of time.
Let's have a music trivia nerd off.
Yeah, anyway, yeah. Like yeah, but, like so you're gonna start hearing like
so you can,
we're
so
bonking
you can,
each other on the head.
I think that you can safely make the argument that the contrarian like I think we're all in agreement. Like this is a pretty contrarian record of its time. Like, it didn't sound like a lot of other stuff, except for maybe derivative of or influenced by or inspired by the Velvet Underground, which in itself was also doing a different thing that was intentionally, like intending to be out of left field, like Warhol. And yet, you know, sort of, he had his own, like, if we sort of take that full circle, he took things that were of pop culture and made them art. They were doing a little bit of that too.
I mean, that's an interesting thing about, and just talk about the factory for a second. One of the most fascinating things is about, I mean, there's so much that's fascinating about Andy Warhol to me, but co-opting popular culture and turning it on its head just by, I mean, it's very insidious what he was doing, but then also allowing and encouraging artistic and musical and, you know, all the other stuff they were putting on productions and stuff, you know, within.
Man, those movies are hard to watch, though.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I don't know if you've ever tried sleep? To sit through one.
Yeah, do you want to watch a three-hour movie about a dude asleep?
Is there really a three-act structure?
No.
But there was an encouragement of a lot of push and pull with the dominant, not musical paradigm, but just entertainment paradigm structure and stuff at the time. Within that, and that dude was really a lot of the reason why that was allowed to foster. It was the soil that the seeds were planted in to give
birth. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
To this,
he fostered an environment that, you know, kind of encouraged a left field brand of creativity.
Well, and it's interesting because you had that stuff going on. You had that stuff going on in California where you had, like, you know, the precursor to that would have been King Kesey with the Merry Pranksters in the late 50s, early 60s. But the difference is...
drug culture?
Oh, no, the drugs. Yeah. Like, you had heroin on one hand and you had LSD and weed and mushrooms on the other hand.
Cocaine.
Yeah, but you... I mean, I think the big... I see a lot more of... seems to, not that it was more structured in the factory, definitely not, but there was more of a hierarchical structure, and it encouraged over a period of time a lot more, and of course a lot of people are going to disagree with me on this, a lot more creativity, I think, at the end of the day.
At the very least, I think the thing that's difficult to argue with is that here's a situation where this band and anybody that was sort of running in this, and when I say this band, I mean like the Modern Lovers as influenced by and in turn connected to some of the moving parts from the Velvet Underground. You know, you have these guys that are sort of they're definitely sort of positioning themselves as counterculture, but they also have great resources and that great artistic resources. So it allows you kind of the freedom, at least the way that I see it, to go out and do something with confidence that doesn't sound like anything else, except maybe your friends.
That's a really good way to. That's a really interesting. Yeah. Thanks. Good job.
This guy over here.
Pardon me while I drop this mic. Anyway, so I guess the other thing is that, you know, I think for me the track that I always connected with the most on this record was Pablo Picasso.
And, well, who apparently was. According to Jonathan Richman, was never called an asshole. But I have a hard time believing that.
I have a hard time believing that, too. And maybe just not in a language that he spoke.
Well, and this is it's another one of those songs where he's talking about, like Jonathan Richman, throughout this record, keeps talking about how much he wants to, like, pick up a girl. And apparently Pablo Picasso, in Jonathan Richman's eyes anyway, like, could just pick up women left and right and never be called an asshole for it.
I think
after the facts, like, well, you know, but not.
Why don't we get into Jonathan Richman's take on this? And
let's do that.
Some people try to pick up girls and get called assholes. This never happened to Pablo Picasso. He could walk down your street and girls could not resist the stare, and so Pablo Picasso was never called an asshole. Well, the girls would turn the color of the avocado when he would drive down their street in his Eldorado. He could walk down your street and girls could not resist the stare. Pablo Picasso never got called an asshole, not like you.
Okay, so
wait, before you do that, can I just say
Mark's ready to go whenever whoever goes ready to go.
just before we started recording again, Mark said, I'm ready to go when
whenever
whoever is ready to go, I'm ready to go.
And then he also said, how you can just say asshole in any language.
I'm ready to go when wherever whoever is ready to go, I'm ready to go.
Yeah. At any rate, bless the internet for it is solving all of our questions.
How do you say asshole in French? Isn't that what you were using it for?
Yeah, I was going to look that up. Give me.
He was worried about looking up French asshole.
There's a lot of languages in here.
So here's.
So
the
it'll
question.
Be maudit vache.
Ah, Gesundheit.
So we got the borscht spilled dad comedian.
I love how there's Quebec.
Take my wife.
Francais Quebec is Stephen Harper.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. So. What was the movie? Does anybody remember what the movie was?
What's the deal with
Stay With Me? Stay With Me. What was the movie where Emilio Estevez and maybe Charlie Sheen was in it? I don't know. Were they
Men at Work?
Trash collectors?
Men at Work.
This song is in
that
movie.
Wait. I totally guessed it. I was right.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah. Anyway.
All right.
You had me at Emilio Estevez.
Yeah. I was going to say something along those lines.
I was like, but it was one of those deals where it was like, I was like, I had already come into contact with that song, and I had just seen, caught a bit or piece of that movie, and I was like, oh, hey, that was during the early days of cable when they would show anything. Anyway,
unlike now.
No, this was always my favorite song on this record, and just not. I mean, part of it was just because, you know, when I was younger, they were just like taking the word asshole and putting it out there. And Pablo Picasso did have a surly reputation. So it was like, I'm pretty sure
he has been called an asshole. And can I just point this out? Yeah. It's a mere technicality, but really, Picasso and asshole don't actually rhyme, and he treats them as if they do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, it's proto-punk. They're not playing by your rules.
Yeah. Hey, man, I don't have to use your rules, man.
I really think you're picking at it here.
This song is slightly frightening to me. I had not heard it before, at least to my record. I'm not sure I have, but it's slightly frightening to me.
And yet you know Men at Work.
Yes, I do.
The movie.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you know, growing up in a small town, we had a movie theater with three screens and only one movie theater, and that was one of the movies that played
there you go.
One time. So,
yeah. Did you pay money to go sit in the theater and
No, Nathan and I used to go on Tuesdays for Dollar Night, so I think we went and saw it like Dollar Night. But I may not have, because I don't remember it. I just remember the poster.
Cinema.
So anyway, this song is slightly frightening to me lyrically because it really sounds like a manifesto of like a frustrated, like if the internet were out back in 72.
Damn, the internet went out.
Somebody plug it back in.
If the internet were around in 72, this guy might have channeled his frustrations into eventually going and on a college campus with a pistol or something like no girls like me.
That's the thing.
I know what you're saying, but that's kind of what it sounds like.
Well, there's an overarching motif with this entire record is that he does kind of seem like a lonely, pathetic dude.
He's definitely bitter in this song.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's bitter. And I guess that's what I'm touching on. Like it's a joke to say like it's lyrically frightening, but it is true. Like a lot of times you get to read a lot on the internet about guys that can't get girlfriends and they're very bitter or can't get a look from a girl. They're very bitter about it.
Is there a funnier, more line full of swagger than the girls would turn the color of the avocado when he would drive down the street in his Eldorado?
In his Eldorado, yes.
Like that
it's like Pablo Picasso's driving around in like a half truck, half car hybrid.
Yeah, it's like, and it totally like in that sense. Like,
wait, that's
totally,
an El Camino,
isn't it? Yes.
His black and white striped shirt and his beret.
Exactly. So it kind of paints the picture.
I just kept going back to that John Lovitz SNL sketch where he's like just being a real prick in like a cafe in Paris and like paying for his drinks with cocktail napkins just where he'd sign his name. He's like, here's your kid's college education.
I didn't see that, but that's...
It's pretty great.
That's pretty great, yeah. Speaking of pretty great, we're going to go to the intermission now. And Ryan, I've been assured that...
A few minutes with.
And we've all been assured that Ryan picked this week, and we'll talk about it in a minute, but we've all been assured that it's worth watching.
It is many good times. Shane is drinking a beer that tastes like a fart.
You don't know that it tastes like a fart. You said it smelled like a fart.
Well, Mark was making a frowny face.
I thought there was a skunk outside the garage door.
It was quite skunky.
A German skunk.
In any case, we are going to cover a intriguing, to say the least, video by Mr. Billy Squier.
And can I say something? Like just like for whatever reason, like it seems to be common knowledge that this guy's career ended up falling on hard times, at least in part because of what we're about to witness.
This video.
You
mentioned last week that
he considers this to be the downfall of his career, this particular video.
Anyway, yeah, so I saw it years ago. I have not seen it in a long, long time.
I didn't see it at the time when it came out, or I don't remember it, but I did see it like 4 or 5 years ago. There was a like digital music channel, Austin Music Network, and it was just came on, and I was blown away.
I just have that. Did this come out any time around when Miami Vice was popular?
Oh, I think definitely. Okay. You'll see a lot of Dayglo pastel, but like we'll get into that. But we will be talking about "Rock Me Tonight" by Billy Squier. So let's take a look at it, and we'll see you on the other end. Yeah.
Twain.
Oh, Mr. Squire.
Whoa.
that was an
ill-advised. This is one of these cases where this podcast just fails the audience completely.
Just, well, let us just recommend that you go check that video out.
Like,
now,
do it now. Yeah. Go to YouTube. Least, Rock Me Tonight by Billy Squire.
We'll still be here. Go ahead.
Unlike when we listened to Ronnie James Dio's 50s doo-wop band, you can actually watch this video, and as well you should.
Everybody should. It's mandatory.
It should be man. This you should have this video and the Journey video for Separate Ways, where they're all playing.
Oh, they're all like huddled up.
They're all huddled up, but they're all like the guy's playing air keyboards. One guy's playing air drums.
Well, it's Billy Squire air guitars to his own song.
That's right.
But in a very effete way.
Very effete. Yes.
Yeah. I would like to see this video not only be the downfall of his career, but the resurgence of his career. Let's make that.
I think it probably does have a cult following because I kind of love it in a.
You kind of love it?
It's like.
Whoa. You need to take the words "kind of" and remove them.
Well, I love it in a and this.
I love it in a way that I cannot put into words.
It feels like there's a certain amount of rubbernecking that goes on with this video.
Well, no, it's watching a car crash. Yeah.
What you're watching. So let me just spell it out a little bit. He wakes up in his bed in his like weird loft that has like
industrial equipment, like
multicolored satin sheets.
Yeah, and then he proceeds to put on his own song. And then he dances, and he sort of air drums like, and air guitars his way through it. But mostly, it's sort of like
he prances,
very effeminate prancing. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
He's like it's like little effeminate prancing and some little kicks and lots of like jazz handy stuff going on. I mean, it's like he wandered off the set of a chorus line.
Part of it is like he's a little bit like a hyperactive kid with a sparkler. Like there's just a and three quarters of the way.
Well, and he air guitars and he air mics too. Like singing along with it.
Three quarters of the way through the video, somebody finally gives this guy a guitar, and he's still doing the same stupid stuff with his legs. And all you can see if you watch the video is everything that he did before he had the guitar, because his legs are still running around like they're out of control
and somehow
the rest of his body.
And somehow it makes more sense, though. Once you put a guitar in his hand, it's like, oh, he's just a musician. That's
well, right. But if I'm Billy Squire, I go back and look at that video before it gets released to the public, and I'm like, let's just move that part with the guitar up to the front.
if the whole video had been like that portion of the video, like we wouldn't be talking about it now.
No, of course
no,
not.
We'd just be talking about the drummer with the exceptionally high cymbals.
The unreasonably high cymbal.
It's not just the unreasonably high cymbals. Also, if you guys remember, the drummer is also playing footsie with Billy Squire. Like, there's a long, drawn-out thing where they like, are kicking at each other.
There's a homoerotic motif throughout
that video.
There is
a homoerotic motif all throughout the video.
Doesn't he tear off one of his own concert shirts?
He tears off one of his own shirts.
He's wearing his own swag.
And then it fades to black and comes back, and he's wearing a new shirt.
Because he ripped the old one.
He ripped the old one off himself.
So they cut to the new shirt.
He ripped it off himself while he's laying down.
There is some
undulating.
Issues.
Yeah, I believe undulating. He was undulating at the moment. So we had a little mini discussion about The Stroke because he was like, "Oh, this." Because I actually do think it's a decent song. Like,
it's
Rock
not Nintendo. Just a decent song. I think it's probably one of the better songs. I don't remember this song at all. I did remember the video, but not as well as I do. We'll never forget it again. But this song is pretty goddamn. It sounds like kind of a Def Leppard. Mid-tempo, mid-80s
light metal
song.
Yeah.
I mean, a great chorus, like really, and actually tastefully done. Like the guitar lick is really, there's no solo in it, really, like no, screeching, no, it's just a good mid-tempo.
So you mentioned that you thought it was better than The Stroke, and I really like
considerably.
That
considerably,
and Mark does too.
I prefer Lonely as the Night.
Okay, so we've all got our favorite in the Squire canon.
I can't stand the song The Stroke. I like the idea of it.
I do like it, but what I wanted to bring up is that it was one of the very first videos I ever saw on MTV. Like, we got cable in, what, like, 81,
long
something
time
like that?
Yeah, when it first came
yeah.
out.
Yeah. And all I could think of, I don't know, I would have been like,
TV,
I would have been
like, one cable.
Like 8 or 9.
It was just a cable. You just exactly. stuck it in your yeah. mouth.
It actually was our remote wasn't even a remote. It was connected to the like cable box, yeah. and it had you know like punch little buttons.
Had
and
like
stuff.
One button on.
Yeah.
it.
Yeah. Anyway, but I do remember watching the video for The Stroke, and it was a concert video, and I just kept going like, man, that guy really looks like he has to pee. And I think that's just how he dances. Like he brings his knees
well, like
up.
Like Kevin said, he's like a hyperactive toddler or something.
Seriously, just about.
Yeah. Maybe that's just his thing. But you know, it looks less dorky when he's on stage doing it with musicians around him. Than
no,
when
he doesn't.
He's prancing around.
Slightly less. I'll give you yeah. that. Can I ask you a question? Do you like The Stroke as a song, or do you like it because it ties you to a simpler time in your life when you had a mullet and a Camaro that you could just drive out to the lake and like turn up your tape deck really loud with your buddies and drink
yes
beer.
On both counts. I genuinely like that song.
Yeah. I think you like it
to the point where Eminem like used like a giant sample from that on a song recently and played on Saturday Night Live and. I was like, oh, yeah, I fucking love this song. And it's just because I genuinely
well, and that's
like
a,
that song.
That's the thing I think we can agree about is that in his heyday, Billy Squire was wrote really catchy light metal pop songs that were like they felt like they had a little bit of an edge. And if you weren't hearing anything else that sounded exactly like that, Living in the Burbs, like it was pretty engaging stuff. That said, don't dance like that. Like, that's all.
Yeah, that was ill-advised. Management failed him.
Well, I would like. I love that the version of this that we just watched. At some point, like just a few seconds into the video, the words come up, like what the song is, who the artist is, and directed by.
Oh, like Kenny Ortega.
Kenny Ortega.
And I was just thinking, like, man, I don't know if you want to take a credit on this one, man.
That's
like Alan Smithy.
So, So if you're wondering and if you haven't seen it and like you're gonna just listen to you're gonna truck on through the rest of the podcast. More to you, brother. Beyond that. If you're watching the video or if you haven't seen the video and you want to know what the dancing looks like, it basically looks like it's like kind of like there's a hinge on the outside of both side of his knees and he just and his legs kick out to the side and at the same time he's snapping like a madman.
Yeah.
And
It reminded me not of the dance scene from Footloose. But of the
one dance scene in Footloose.
Well, the running around dancing scene in Footloose.
Oh yeah, where he jumps out the end of the thing.
It was parodied by Flight of the Conchords. That's what it reminds me of the Flight of the Conchords parody of the Footloose.
Well, no, this seems like a parody of himself.
Had the video ended with an ambulance showing up, then everybody could have said, "Oh, that makes sense."
Yeah, well, yeah, clearly he's having an episode.
But when you say parody, like, or I mean, if it were, and I'm positive it's not, but if it were satire or a parody, the people that were listening to Billy Squire in 1985,
they were not going to be loving this.
Were not? No. they don't. I'm pretty sure they don't have a grasp on parody or satire. In their Camaro with their mullets down by the lake.
And they probably also weren't listening to Kenny Loggins.
And looking at it through the modern day lens, though, like, good Lord. I mean,
okay,
it's fun. It's fun to watch.
This kind of, if this is who I think, if it's the same.
This is great audio, Shane.
No. I'm just, it looks like he's a choreographer.
Who, Kenny Ortega?
Kenny Ortega.
Or he was.
So yeah.
Kenny Ortega is a director and a choreographer, and he choreographed, among other notable releases, Xanadu.
That sounds about right.
Okay.
Sounds about right with what we know. Also, Dirty Dancing. And to Wong Fu, thanks for everything, Julie Newmar. It's all coming more into focus.
It's coming sharper into focus.
Hold on. High School Musical choreographer and director.
Oh.
High School Musical 2 and 3. Hannah Montana and Miley Cyrus. It's all...
The thing that really is getting me here, though, is that the idea that this was in any way choreographed.
Well, this is kind of just how Billy Squire dances, because he does it in other videos. However, like, who have you pointed out, like, you know, you just want to, like, hear the offstage direction.
Yeah, like, I wanted to hear Kenny Ortega, like, more effeminate,
more
snapping.
Prancing,
yeah, exactly.
Yes.
That's sort of
more prancing. Get those knees up higher, buddy.
And, like, if you're looking for, like, a storyline, you're watching the video, like, where is he going? He's not going anywhere. He's just snapping around
He's
the house.
Some dude getting ready to go out, dancing to the music on his way to get dressed.
Wait a second, there's another room, and his band is in there.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, they just
that's
there.
That's his pre-show warm-up.
Unreasonably high cymbals.
Because remember, he just woke up.
Hey, fellas.
Yeah.
I love how he just woke up and his hair was like...
throws on his jammies and prances around
the room.
Oh, yeah. Like, well, look, my band.
Oh, my band. I better go play the show.
Somebody get me my guitar.
That's why they call them jammies.
Jesus Christ. And on that note...
let's go talk about Modern Lovers.
Let's talk a little more about Modern Lovers. By the way, this song was his highest charting U.S. single, but then immediately after the video came out, people started, ticket sales took a nosedive.
Plummeted.
He never recovered.
That's what happens.
And he fired his managers.
And then we go back to talking about a band that actually wasn't technically together. Certainly in the incarnation that this record was put together in.
If you look at their page, the Modern Lovers page, how many band members were in this thing? I mean, basically, it's Jonathan Richman and, like,
people,
15 other people who
drifted
in and out at various times.
Yeah, and it became, like, the Modern Lovers became a sort of a backing band / side project for Jonathan Richman, but that's one of the reasons why. And, yeah, I mean, beyond the fact that this first record is terrific, and the guys who left the band... Several of them, or a couple of them at least, went on to do some things that were really, really interesting.
The Cars, Talking Heads, yep. What Have You.
Yeah, What Have You.
The What Have You's is my favorite.
I love What Have You's.
What Have You's are pretty good.
What Have You is a singular conceit. Anyway, I don't know what I'm talking about. Anyway, the point being...
shit, I'm glad that you finally admitted that.
Whatever. Thanks. Yeah. Anyway,
Shane, you're drinking a beer that tastes like a fart.
Yeah, exactly.
It actually tastes pretty good.
And yeah, wearing a toque at the same time.
So and even if it did taste like a fart, I wouldn't fucking admit it to you. I'd continue to drink it. But it doesn't.
Just to spite me.
Anyway. Yeah. Okay, I think the other thing that I found particularly interesting about this record is we talked a little bit, we've talked quite a bit about some of the contrarian stances that are taken by the band just from... You know, Shane ran through the litany of the acts that were showing up in the top 20, you know, in 1972.
The era.
In that area, and then again in 1976. And, like, sure, it's easy to draw that parallel. But when you sort of dive down to the fact that he was going, like, so contrarian to the point where, you know, where he was talking about, like, just, like, I don't, like... And it wasn't necessarily – he didn't refer to – and this is just a terminology difference, but he didn't refer to the difference between like being – not being on anything.
I think he's
leading into the song we're going to talk about. Which,
oh, okay.
I'm straight, which if you read it now with today's mindset, you're like, well – okay, dude, you don't have to tell me. Like,
yeah, we know you're looking for chicks.
You've been talking about it the whole record. Yeah. Like,
but the nomenclature.
But that's not what he meant.
Yeah, and the thing to me that is really interesting to note about that song in particular, among a few things, is that, and this kind of harkens back to the fact that these guys did, You know, they cut a demo for A&M Records. They cut a demo for what's the other? Was it
Warner Brothers?
Yeah, and those ended up being cobbled together to form the first incarnation.
Do we know what label this came out on? Like, finally, did it show up?
It's not Berkeley. It's something like Berserkly.
Berserkly. In my mind, this record, even though it was out of print for 20 years, and even though it, you know, never initially really did anything, is so much more influential to
now.
Now in the 90s, and mm-hmm. I mean, it's so much than Roberta Flack. And,
oh yeah, that stuff was, you know, like evaporated on impact, and this one has staying power.
Yeah, yeah, there's some gravity to it.
So the song we want to listen to, I'm Straight, this was part of the Kim Fowley sessions, the 1973 demo sessions. And this was not on the original 1976 release, but this was on the 86 reissue from Berserkly Records. So.
All right, well, let's get into it.
All right, here it is.
'Cause here's your chance to make me feel awkward and wish that I had never even called up this place. I saw you though today walk by with Hippie Johnny. I had to call up and say how I wanna take his place. So this phone call today concerns Hippie Johnny. He's always stoned. He's never straight. I saw you today, you know, walk by with Hippie Johnny. Look, I had to call up and say I wanna take his place. See, he's stoned, Hippie Johnny. Now get this, I'm straight.
Crying out loud.
Hippie Johnny.
Hippie Johnny.
Hippie Johnny. Like, and here's the thing. It's like, this is 2015. I don't know when the last time that anybody of us ran into a hippie. I don't, like...
I run into... Even in Austin.
Shane goes to the Kerrville Folk Festival yearly. And so he does run into hippies.
I have a lot of hippie friends, but here's the deal, is that a lot of the hippie stuff from 1972 has been absorbed into the greater culture, so nobody actually calls anybody
hippie anymore.
Hippie Ryan, Hippie Johnny, don't you get the feeling like they used to say, like, oh, well, that's Chinaman, blah blah blah, or that's Black, blah blah blah, or that's, you know, like, you see this in old, like, comedy movies.
Look, it's Black Steve.
Yeah, Black Steve, Black Frank, or that was like these descriptor things. Hippie Johnny.
Well, I will say this song does like adhere to the motif that is throughout the record, in that he's kind of a pathetic, like, girl obsessed dude, and in this case, Hippie Johnny apparently is dating the object of his affection, and his angle on it is that, hey man, that guy's stoned all the time and I'm not.
Yeah.
So let's...
To that end, he's like, well, why can't he do what he's... Yeah. Why can't he do it on the level? It's like... But that's also the kind of thing that like, you know, it's the fist against the moon of a teenager.
Is that an expression?
Wait, what? Can you just repeat what you said?
It is the fist against the moon of a teenager.
That's so it rolls off the tongue. It's part of the popular nomenclature.
It sounds like it should be a thing, but I don't think it is.
Fist against the moon of a teenager. Yeah. Did you just...
Yeah, I'm just riffing. I'm scatting, man.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. That's some scat.
That's some serious scat.
It's a fist against the moon of a teenager. Let me take you under my wing and show you how it's done.
My brother William S. Burroughs over here.
I'm a dude in a giant puffy coat in a garage.
Those things are true. But that poem was not quite as inspired as the one that you had introduced.
I riffed a moment ago. Yeah.
Fist Against the Moon of a Teenager.
So I did look
it up. I'm calling my debut album Fist Against the Moon of a Teenager.
I looked it up, and the only thing it says is that something that Kevin Newsom would say.
Well, there we go.
So this guy, Hippie Johnny, reminds me of
You were saying Frank Mills.
Frank Mills, which is
the
a
last song,
song on
It's a Shame About Ray from the Lemonheads.
Which is a cover. It comes from the musical Hair, apparently. I knew it was a cover, but I've never seen Hair. And you know why I've never seen Hair? Because fucking Meatloaf was originally in Hair. And anything that's associated with that motherfucker.
You mean
hippie
Meatloaf?
Hippie Meatloaf before he became meaty Meatloaf or whatever.
He's gluten-free Meatloaf.
He's a beefy dude. I'll just say that.
Anyway, yeah. So this is another one of those. This is one of the songs on the record that is very much about, you know, to Ryan's point, it's about a guy longing after a girl that he can't have. But it's also about, you know, it's also about that whole like sort of contrarian stance that he took during a time when nobody was standing that way, which is like, hey, I like my parents. Hey.
I like old
people.
I'm
not getting stoned. So, yeah, so it stands to reason that he had some time to write songs.
Dude probably, like, at the time was a very insufferable person to be around.
I suspect. I suspect Jonathan Richman was sometimes called an asshole.
No way. Yes, I would as well. There's a reason why the motherfucker wasn't getting laid at the time.
Okay, so I had this ex-girlfriend who was like, I'm so tired. She dated a lot of like English major types, like kind of nerdy intellectuals, and she was like, I'm so tired of guys who feel like getting a girlfriend will like save them. And I never really knew what she meant, but when I listened to this record, I feel like he's who she was talking about.
Yeah. I would always – well, that's another
thing.
You know, like all I need to do to fix my life is get this girl, because that's all he wants to talk about in the record. And the record's great, but it is kind of a one-note, like, lyrically packaged.
It's almost like it's the fist to the moon.
It's kind of like
the teenager girl.
Of a teenager.
Yeah.
Teenage girl.
Why can't you guys see the image that I'm talking about?
I can't. And my brain is feverishly working. I immediately just came up with like that the poster from like what was the movie with Tatum O'Neal and Ryan O'Neal? Paper Moon.
Paper Moon.
Yeah. That's all like, no, and then the fist in the middle
like,
of it.
It's
but
like
I
sort of, so you take the mashup idea of barking at the moon, and then you take the anchor.
Wait, we're starting with an Ozzy Osbourne song?
We're going back to Ozzy Osbourne.
Okay, wait. So, wait. No, do tell, because
God damn it, man. Once in my life, I'm going to complete a thought on this podcast. So
I can't wait to see where it goes.
Yeah. So you take the cliche of barking at the moon, and you couple that with the teenager's angst, and them raising a fist in the night in 80s cliche Billy Squier style, if it weren't so effete, and make it into a thing. Like that's kind of where I was going.
You've made
totally
a thing.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I
kind of now have a different mashup in my brain. Now it's like the Paper Moon, and then it's like a Che Guevara poster.
A little. Yeah. Okay. Now we're on the same page.
Hey. So, Kevin, this album is great. This is you're picking some good ones these days. You guys need to continue to pick good ones because
you pick pieces of shit.
I've been picking good ones too, but I've got some stuff coming down the tracks.
That I'm never going to forgive you for Bon Jovi.
Oh, you're never going to forgive me for some stuff I've got planned.
All right.
We're
getting into
A Current Affair. Yeah, we're going to listen to a song that came out in the last 12 months. So we'll see you on the other side.
What killed Karen Carpenter was a combination of medications.
The Karen Carpenter cover-up.
Hello, everyone. I'm Maureen O'Boyle. Welcome to A Current Affair.
Something better.
much interested to hear what you guys think about that song. Well, the video and the song. I'll tell you this. Like, this is before, and you guys, neither of you.
We're talking about Tahiti 80. What's the name of the song?
Tahiti 80 Crush is the, Crush. I'm sorry, I forgot we didn't say before.
We have not teased this song.
It's a song by Tahiti 80, which is a French pop band that I've liked for some period of time that I didn't think made music anymore. And then I got turned onto this song, and I was like, this song is amazing. Who is this? Oh, Tahiti 80. Who
Which
knew?
I haven't even thought of since the, Jesus, how long ago was it?
2001, 2002?
It was on my birthday. Yeah. Kevin and I saw both Tahiti 80 and the band Travis.
We all went to that Travis show, actually.
That's right.
And then you guys and Darren Murphy. I don't know if Darren Murphy went with you. Oh, by the way, Darren Murphy, Austin, brilliant musician, is going to be on the show in a couple weeks. So.
Pop savant.
Yes, he is a pop savant. I love how Kevin and I, like, we're just nodding
yeah,
together.
Yep, that's what he is.
That's what he is. You guys went around the corner. We saw Travis play in this, you know, outdoor amphitheater, and then right around the corner is a long, beloved, relatively recently departed sweaty punk club, Emos, and Tahiti 80 play there. So we go way back with this band. But I knew that nobody knew that this band was putting out music still.
I thought they were long broken up.
Yeah, well, they're still on the same major label. That's the amazing. They had to have been selling lots of records somewhere. Yeah.
Not in the States.
So,
One of the things that I remember about this band was that they, just from an original write-up that popped up around the time that we probably went to go see that show, Lowe, so many years ago, was that many of them went to, I want to say that this was the angle, like, this was the angle in the piece, which was that many of the guys in this band, either they met, or it turns out that they all went to, like, the American University in Paris, or they went to, like, they essentially studied to they were all interested in American culture or sounding,
Americana,
sounding more, you know, like mastering English or whatever.
Hence, they sing
in English, but they sound totally French.
Yeah,
and so that's always been one of the things that I've like. And frankly, the songs are great and fun and accessible, and so I've always been a sucker for these guys.
I like that they have taken a page out of the famous Billy Squier book of how not to make a music video.
We will get to that in a minute, but before we do. Not that this video in any way touches on.
It does not.
It gets nowhere near that in common with
Rock Me Tonight.
That's what I was trying to say.
But it is, yeah. So the song, I think, and I'm a fan of this band, I think that this is the best song I've ever heard them put out, personally. I love this song. I think it's a perfect pop. It makes me feel like Loveful. Get in and get out.
The Cardigans?
Yeah, in three minutes, perfect song from start to finish. That's how I
don't like it as much as that, but I think it's a thoroughly
decent
song.
I
like
it as much as Loveful. Loveful is a perfect song. I said it's in that vein, but it's that kind of, it's a amazing pop song.
I think that it very much feels like it is of this band. Like this is very much in their wheelhouse, and they make sunny, like really great sunny pop songs. This is totally one of those. It's totally probably my own bias. I'm just such a sucker for some of the original stuff that they put out because it sounds like they're finding their way and at the same time putting out these pop gems. That this sounds a little bit more polished. So,
you're right, and I see that, and that's partially why you're right. When you said finding their way, I think that's a really astute assessment of what was going on.
So that video is all digital, right?
Except for the chick. I mean, like, she's in digital clothing.
Yeah. Well, I just, like, really early on, there's, like, a mechanical owl in it, so I got this Clash of the Titans thing in my head.
Yeah, I got some of that, too.
Yeah, that wouldn't really go away, but, like, none of the rest of the video is like that, but there's a mechanical owl in it, and so...
Well, no, the rest of the video, there's, like, little... It looks like Metropolis, like there's like gold mouthless men.
I kept going to Flash Gordon and
The Flash Gordon. Yeah, it's a little excess.
Yeah. Somebody made a Dune reference during the Mark?
Yes.
Yeah. It's one of
it's
those
pretty French.
I don't
All I'm going to say, Safeway.
I don't particularly like this video. I love the song. I don't really need to see the video. It's the exact contrast of the video that I picked last time we did this for our inaugural current affair, that Bridges, that video, which upon repeated viewing, so much more.
Yeah, there's pays
so much
off more
depth, and, like, and, yeah. And it, but it seems to be very simple. And the more you watch it, the more it comes out.
I would say that this video distracts from the song.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I mean, and there, but there, and there's nothing. There's no ultimate. Like you could have a. It doesn't have to have a message to it. God knows it could be. It could just be. This just doesn't. There's nothing. It's like Michael Bay moonlighting.
There's no there there. Well, and
there's no there there. It depends on what your definition of is.
Yeah.
But I think my point of the video too, where I was going with it was that the band has nothing really to do with this video other than providing the music at that point. I mean,
yeah, they handed it off to somebody who hit a bunch of keys on a computer.
But I don't care. But that's you can do that all the time. I mean, like that's not what I mean for me personally. What
I mean, we can't all be Kenny Ortega.
Can we?
Yeah. but I think I see where you're going with that. But I like for me personally, like watching this video, it's just a bunch of flashy, splashy images with nothing that's actually interesting in them. You know what I mean?
Yes, but I guess my real point is that you could make a dozen or even more videos to this song, and the song would still be as good as it is.
Yeah, no, the song is amazing. I mean, it's a great song. Oh, getting back to what you were saying a second ago, though, you were saying like in their older stuff where it feels like they're finding their way and this is more polished. That's kind of why it's a little more interesting to me. They're sort of like these kind of go-for-broke, ballsy decisions. Like we were talking about this, it kind of sounds like the whole song was like somebody took the master tapes and left them in the sun to warp slightly. I mean, that's really interesting to me.
That is interesting.
And
the vocals are slightly off-key.
They are, but the rest of the song kind of has this whole warbly thing going on to it, too.
What are we doing next week, kids?
So, you have next week's.
Okay, so we may or may not have Chris Cox on next week?
Yeah, so that's going to be – let's just operate like we're not, but okay, if he is, then he is. You know what? Let's see. This is how it's going
to
go.
Remind and though they're coming to us through the website, so they may have every idea who Chris is – Tell the audience.
Chris Cox and Brian Salisbury are essentially like the big.
Michaels of the website.
Yeah, let's just say that they're the Lorne Michaels of this website. Yeah, that's a good way to say it. And so Chris is going to be coming on the show soon. And if you guys haven't gotten a chance to check out Highly Suspect Reviews, that's one of their shows on the site. And then there's a couple other ones that people just. You know, it's incestuous.
There are various podcasts on the site.
Yes,
and Chris's one is highly suspect. Highly suspect.
It's one of them. And then there's the original gentleman. But anyway, so we are going to review "Goo" by Sonic Youth, which he picked for us.
When
to do.
He shows up.
When he shows up. So if he shows up next week, that's what we'll talk about. If he doesn't, every week until he does, we'll say we're going to do "Goo" next week or.
Or a surprise.
Or no, that's
also,
surprise.
Also, sorry, Matt Damon, we had to bump you.
Yeah.
So if he's not on next week, we're going to do Ryan.
Blood on the Tracks by Bob Dylan.
Which I'm super excited.
Sounds great.
I can't wait to listen to it.
You guys do.
Fist against wait, the moon.
Why don't the three of you get in your clown car and take that fucking act on the road, please?
Yeah. because 45 minutes of that.
Coming to your town tonight.
Well, I think where Kevin actually from? Saw Bob Dylan play, and he played the entire show with his back to the audience.
Oh, that's amazing. Because he doesn't owe you anything anymore.
Yeah. Fuck you, man.
Okay, yeah.
All right, kids, we got to get out of here.
All right, well, we'll see you.
Till next week.
I'll see you guys in 7 days, right?